From North State Public Radio, I'm Andre Bayek with your headlines for Friday, October 28th. Congenital syphilis rates have been on the rise in California over the last decade.
In 2020, we had 107 cases per 100,000 live births, which is an 11-fold increase from the decade prior.
That was CalMatters reporter Kristen Wong. Later in this report, we'll have an interview with Wong, who wrote a recent article about the issue and how health officials in Shasta County are approaching the problem. But first, we start with a story we've been following in Butte County, where the Paradise Town Council earlier this month heard an update on the town's long-term recovery plan after the 2018 campfire. As NSPR's Jamie Jiang reports, the recovery plan was updated based on results from a survey of residents.
The survey was circulated from March to April of this year in order to inform 13 new recovery projects. The town first released the results of that survey on April 27th and 28th during public meetings. The survey responses highlighted challenges faced by those who chose to rebuild. Residents said cost of labor and materials posed the largest obstacle to rebuilding housing, with the threat of steadily increasing insurance a close second. Only half of respondents were able to purchase homeowners insurance other than the California FAIR plan, the state's alternate property insurance for high-risk homeowners. Paradise residents also said they were very concerned about the lack of affordable housing. About half of the respondents thought workforce, market rate, and low or very low income housing should be the focus of rebuilding in Paradise moving forward. The town's long-term recovery plan, updated in accordance with the survey's results and any progress made, now recommends several new projects. Those include finding subsidies and supporting legislature that bring affordable insurance alternatives to residents, adopting fire-safe building standards for the town to lower insurance costs, making affordable homes more accessible for first-time buyers, beautifying the town, and providing more accountability for contractors. For NSPR News, I'm Jamie Jiang.
The North State and other regions in California saw record-breaking heat this year, and we're not alone. A new report finds children throughout the United States are experiencing frequent heat waves. CAP Radio's Manola Sakaita has more.
The UNICEF report found that 90% of children in the U.S. experienced frequent heat waves in 2020. That's a big jump from the global average for kids, which was 24% that same year. And that average is getting higher. Whether or not greenhouse gas emissions are reduced, the report predicts all 2 billion children worldwide will experience frequent heat waves by 2050. Lisa Patel is a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at Stanford. She says children's health is particularly at risk during times of extreme heat.
Children cannot control their environment, so it's incumbent upon us to construct these environments to ensure that they're safe for children.
Patel says schools in certain parts of California, like the Bay Area, aren't equipped with air conditioning.
The schools here were built for a different era and a different climate.
She also says low-income and redlined areas often have fewer resources, making them especially vulnerable to extreme heat. Adding shade and ventilation to places where children frequent, like schools, could help keep them safe. Manola Sakaita, CAP Radio News.
There's just a little over a week until the November election, and California voters are being asked to weigh in on 7 statewide propositions. One of those propositions, Proposition 31, would ban the sale of flavored tobacco in the state. CalMatters reporter Elizabeth Aguilera has more.
In 2020, California lawmakers voted to ban the sale of flavored vape products, menthol cigarettes, and chewing tobacco. But that law hasn't taken effect yet because the tobacco industry collected enough signatures to put a referendum on California's November ballot. Proposition 31 asked voters whether they want the flavored tobacco ban to go into effect. Advocates of the ban argue that flavored products are marketed to young people who go on to develop nicotine addiction. Opponents say the state already bans selling tobacco products to minors and that this law infringes on the freedom of adults. Vote yes if you want flavored tobacco to be illegal in California. Vote no if you want to allow the sale of flavored tobacco products. In Los Angeles, I'm Elizabeth Aguilera.
You can find explainers on all of this year's ballot propositions at calmatters.org. Settlement talks have broken down in a case from San Francisco seeking to preserve federal humanitarian protections for hundreds of thousands of immigrants nationwide. For the California Report, KQED's Farida Javala Romero reports.
U.S. citizen Krista Ramos was only 14 when she became the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit against the Trump administration, which took steps to end the protections that allow Ramos's mom and more than 260,000 others to legally live and work in the U.S. Now she's 18 and a freshman at the University of San Francisco.
Our families are more vulnerable than ever, and we need action from President Biden.
As a candidate, Biden said Trump-era terminations of temporary protected status for people who can't return safely to their home countries were a, quote, recipe for disaster. But his administration has continued defending Trump's terminations in court, impacting immigrants from four countries, including El Salvador. That's where Krista's mom, Cristina Morales, is originally from. She's lived in the U.S. for almost 30 years. She's a teacher at a preschool in Berkeley.
I don't want to leave behind my house, my kids, and I don't want to place them in the situation to choose between me and their country either.
Plaintiff attorneys say they sought modest protections for TPS holders in the settlement talks with the Biden administration. The White House and the Department of Homeland Security did not return requests for comment.
That was KQED's Farida Javala Romero for the California Report. And finally, congenital syphilis happens when a mother passes on the infection to her fetus during pregnancy, and rates have skyrocketed across the state. The infection can be dire if untreated, causing neurological disorders or infant death. But health workers in Shasta County have a unique approach to addressing the problem. Kristen Wong, reporter for the nonprofit news outlet Cal Matters, wrote about their approach. NSPR's Adia White spoke with Wong to learn more about why public health officials are concerned about the rising rates and what's being done in Shasta County.
Public health is sounding the alarm because this is a preventable disease, and I don't think that can be emphasized enough. It's so preventable that in the 90s, the CDC had launched a campaign to eliminate syphilis entirely from the population because rates were so low that they thought that that was possible. And because this is a preventable infection and disease, by the time it's getting passed from a mother to an infant, alarm bells should be ringing. And it really should signal that somewhere along the line, the healthcare system has failed.
And what are some of the reasons behind the rising rates?
California currently has the sixth highest rate of congenital syphilis cases in the country, and those rates have steadily increased every single year. In 2020, we had 107 cases per 100,000 live births, which is an 11-fold increase from the decade prior. And the state health department actually in 2010 had set a target for congenital syphilis rates at 9.6 cases per 100,000 births. So you can see that 107 compared to the 9.6 is far higher than our goal. So to get to some of the reasons around why rates are rising, it's really complicated and the answer is multifaceted. Increasing case rates have gone hand in hand with increasing rates of homelessness and drug use, particularly methamphetamine use, which is increasing in California. But when it comes to congenital syphilis, maternal and congenital syphilis, the number one predictor is inadequate prenatal care. So women who either are not receiving prenatal care at all, or they're receiving it really late in their pregnancies. Those women, it really sort of signifies that there's a really severe inadequate access to healthcare and to other social service systems. A lot of times these women, they might be living on the streets. The nearest doctor to them might be 30 minutes or more away. And so there might be a language barrier, like there's lots of barriers to accessing healthcare.
And you did focus one of your articles on Reading in particular, and you talked about how community health workers are doing outreach to treat and prevent syphilis there. Can you tell us more about why you decided to focus on Reading and the work that they do in that area?
I focused on Reading and Shasta County because they were starting to see a more recent increase in cases. And the Shasta Community Health Center there has made a really sort of impressive and deep commitment to delivering primary health care to the unhoused in Reading. The sort of catchy term that they use is called street medicine. And they partner with the public health department to go out both with a physician or a nurse and a case social services caseworker and a public health department employee to go into the encampments or wherever they're finding people on the streets to just sort of break down these barriers of, you know, the literal barriers of a brick and mortar doctor's office.
You spoke with Dr. Kyle Patton, the medical director of the Hope Street Medicine Team at Shastick Community Health Center, and here's what he had to say.
People that are unsheltered living on the street, people that use substances or IV drug users, like these pockets we haven't been able to reach. And that's not because they don't want that treatment. I think it's because of limitations in how we're delivering healthcare.
Again, that was Dr. Kyle Patton, the medical director of the Hope Street Medicine Team at Shasta Community Health Center.
And actually, I shadowed his team for a little bit to see what that sort of care looks like. From their perspective, it really is about changing the way we think about delivering care, that a lot of people tend to write off whether someone's unhoused or not, if someone is not showing up for a doctor's appointment or not following through with treatment for some reason. Very frequently in medicine, they get written off as like non-compliant or, just kind of like lost to follow up. When there is most of the time, it's not that people don't want the healthcare. There's just something preventing them from getting there. This team in Reading is going out and going into the encampments to, you know, deliver a very high quality of care. Like they can do ultrasounds and all kinds of things out in the field.
You also spoke with one mother in Reading who you said had an unusual case due to the intervention that Shasta County has done. Can you tell us a little bit more about her particular story?
Yeah, the mother I spoke to was really sort of an incredible success story of what can happen when somebody who is the most vulnerable and at risk gets the right resources at the right time for them. So this was a local woman who had been housed sort of on and off the streets for the past 9 to 10 years of her life. And she knew about the street medicine team because they did regular visits. When she found out she was pregnant, she reached out to them and said, "Hey, I'd really like to keep my baby. I need help with housing and I need help with substance abuse treatment." And so they were able to move really quickly to get her into sort of a long-term hotel stay for pregnant women and to get her caught up on prenatal care. She was had a previous history of syphilis. And so she was at risk for contracting it again. And they just had to monitor the baby closely at birth to make sure that nothing was passed down. And it wasn't, which was great because it shows you that when the healthcare intervention is there and accessible, that it works. And then from there, you know, they were able to manage her alcohol withdrawal. She also used methamphetamine. And at the time that I spoke to her, she was 9.5 months sober and her daughter was 2 months old. So it was really, and she had also just gotten keys to an apartment, the first apartment that she's ever had in her adult life. It showed that the work that's done when you sort of think outside the box in terms of healthcare and how you break down these access barriers, how you can prevent cases, because her baby very easily could have been just another number.
That was Kristen Wong, reporter for the nonprofit news outlet Cal Matters, speaking with NSPR's Adia White. You can read Wong's story on our website, mynspr.org. And those are your headlines for Friday, October 28th. Our theme song is Burrow and courtesy of Blue Dot Sessions. For NSPR News, I'm Andre Bayek.